Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to forming a safe zone in Syria. An expert shares his thoughts on the migration crisis facing Europe. A doctor is offering menus to help struggling addicts.
It could change your lives, and it's nothing really extra for the addiction clinics. It's just minor changes, but it'll definitely increase the successful withdrawal rate.
And some top singers sign on to star in a new production of The Wiz. It's right here on The Voice of America. Six U.S. F-16 fighter jets arrived at an airbase in southern Turkey Sunday to join the U.S.-led coalition fight against Islamic State militants, the U.S. military said. Turkey and the U.S. are planning joint military action to clear ISIS militants from an area near the Turkish border. Turkey's going forward with plans to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria. Turkey and Syria share a 900-kilometer border that is frequently used by militants to collect new recruits and supplies. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy discussed the new plan with Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. Say, Mohammed, did you get an explanation from him on the difference between the long-debated no-fly zone in Syria and this idea of a safe zone?
Yes, indeed, Sue. Michael O'Hanlon said the aerial action that has been described means that the safe zone will be very close to the definition of the no-fly zone when it comes to its actual net effect, in a sense that anything that flies once will not get a chance to fly again. However, he is not expecting that establishing such zone will eliminate the presence of the Islamic State or ISIL group from Syria.
There's no doubt that if ISIL is deprived of its major lines of logistical access to the outside world, that it will have to do a lot of things differently. A lot of its operations will become much more difficult. But I'm not sure that it will turn the tide of battle in a way that leads to the decisive defeat of ISIL.
One of the major objectives of establishing a safe zone in northern Syria is to have a springboard for the U.S.-trained Syrian fighters. But some of them have been captured by the other militant group called Nusra Front. How does that all work?
Well, Sue, according to Michael O'Hanlon, this strategy is not working even before these latest developments.
But we know that there was only a very small group that had been trained anyway. And so it looks like the whole effort is under-resourced and undersized for what needs to happen. So the capturing of several of the fighters is obviously regrettable, but I'm not sure it's the most central and important point. The most important point is that we never managed to find very many people who wanted to be part of this in the first place.
So with the military pressure emanating from the new U.S.-Turkish military cooperation inside Syria, convince Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to accept a political transition?
Most experts are skeptical about any compromise soon when it comes to the Syrian conflict, where trust between warring parties is in a very short supply. Let's listen to what O'Hanlon said about this scenario in particular.
I'm extremely skeptical that President Assad will accept the political process leading to a change of government. I think that he views the enemy in the most extreme and dire terms. He thinks the enemy is fundamentally made up of jihadists. Obviously, a lot of them are, but others may not be. But I think he conflates them all together. That's part of how he rationalizes in his own mind killing so many innocent people, because he's persuaded himself, or at least he wants to persuade himself, that he's in a fight to the death with groups that would never be reasonable if they were to take power. And given that he has that perspective, the idea that he's going to negotiate the end of his government in favor of even the more moderate elements of the opposition is quite unlikely.
Thank you, Mohammed, for exploring these aspects with Michael O'Hanlon over at Brookings.
Thank you, Sue, for having me.
Time for a look at what's going on the web concerning ISIS. And joining me with the details is our social media guy, VOA's Michael Lippin. Welcome, Michael, as always.
Thank you, Susan. So I've been looking at the issue of Turkey allowing the Incirlik airbase to be used by U.S. warplanes against Islamic State targets in northern Syria. And I saw an interesting article posted on the Twitter account of Al Monitor. That's a Middle East news website whose handle is at Al Monitor. It posted a link to an analysis piece by a Turkish contributor named Metin Gürçan. That tweet read, U.S. decision makers see Turkey's allowing Interlik to be used by U.S. warplanes as a test of Ankara's sincerity. Now, in that story, Gürçan writes that the true blow to the Islamic State will come from coalition warplanes led by the United States taking off from Interlik on combat missions in northern Syria. Gürçan writes that the strategic bargaining between the United States and Turkey about this issue of Interlik is still going on. He says the Turkish side hopes to use the U.S. desire for access to Interlik as leverage in its battle with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. Gürçan also writes that both the United States and Turkey are tired from haggling over Interlik for the past 4 months. Gürçan also writes that the United States has tried to assure Turkey that it won't support the Syria-based Kurdish militias whom Ankara is suspicious of. But he also says that Ankara doesn't fully trust the United States. Susan?
I'm sure this is going to be an issue for many days to come, maybe weeks, maybe months, who knows?
It could be.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michael, for stopping by today.
Thank you.
And this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Do you like to sleep on your back or on your stomach? If so, you may want to think about some new findings from researchers at Stony Brook University in New York. The researchers discovered that sleeping on your side might help your body remove potentially harmful leftover chemical components from your brain, components that are implicated in neurological diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. The researchers studied MRI images of the glymphatic pathway, which is a complex system for clearing waste, in the brains of sedated rodents as they slept on their back, front, and side positions. The researchers found that waste transport was most efficient when the rodent slept on its side, and say that further MRI imaging research with humans is necessary. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thousands of migrants have arrived at the French port of Calais. They're trying to reach Britain through the Channel Tunnel and the trains that use it. One Sudanese man actually walked the full 50 kilometers through the tunnel and was arrested in Kent, England. Joining me to talk about the situation is International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. I discussed the plight of these migrants in Calais with Itai Variri, a spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration in Geneva. Here's how he described the situation.
For a start, quite a lot of migrants who try to make this journey usually have some family ties in the UK. And they also have ties maybe in terms of language, so some of them speak English, or just have the familiarity of what they think the UK represents in terms of their future prospects.
But at the same time, you're not going to get any benefits just by walking into Britain through the tunnel. They're not going to just hand you things. So if you have no documentation, the British government's not going to help you, correct? So that doesn't really help them, does it?
That is correct in that, you know, the British government does not give benefits to new arrivals. In fact, I think they have very strict rules concerning that. But what usually happens with people who make this kind of journey, you know, people who get up and go and migrate, they usually want to work for themselves. They want to provide for their families, and they really are there to search for jobs. Right now, the UK, out of all the economies in Western Europe, is one of the really successful economies, which has had a very good turnaround from the recent recession. So that certainly filters down to all the migrants in terms of having the knowledge as to where the jobs are to be found. So you find that the majority, I'll say the vast majority of these migrants actually just want to work and be very productive and active workers in the countries that they are hoping to reach.
Among the thousands of people who have massed in Calais, can you give me an idea as to where some of these people came from, where the migration came from?
Well, the majority of them come from countries like Eritrea, Ethiopia, Sudan, Afghanistan, and obviously we usually have Syrians. As you know, quite a lot of Syrians have been leaving the country or their region trying to look for, you know, better opportunities abroad. So these are usually the nationalities that are to be found at Calais right now.
I also see from reading reports about this that this is creating friction between France and Britain. In fact, I see in one report the French Interior Minister has said that Britain must, in his words, go further in mobilizing resources to resolve the situation. What about France itself? What is France doing to help these people?
Well, what usually happens when people go to this locality in Calais that we're talking about is that there is a day center that is usually open that provides some sorts of support for the migrants who are there right now. But it only operates during the day. So at night, the migrants have to fend for themselves. But what I can add to that is that the International Organization for Migration has been consistently calling on the European Union to show some solidarity in terms of assisting these migrants. Right now, we see a situation whereby this union is not actually acting in unison. You see countries reacting differently to this migration crisis. We see a situation where Italy and Greece are getting an overwhelming number of migrants. In fact, between the two of them, they have almost 200,000. And yet, there doesn't seem to be that much broader support from the rest of the EU. So we're saying that there should be more burden sharing. They should be able to share the numbers across the board. But that's not happening right now.
That was Itai Viriri, a spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration based in Geneva.
Well, Jeff, thanks for reaching out to him.
This is an important story, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, eating and drinking to help recovering addicts, and mixing, singing, and acting for entertainment. Alcoholism and drug abuse, could these be linked to the foods that sufferers consume? Dr. Keith Cantor, a nutritionist, believes they are, and he joins us on the line from the southern U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, a great town. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, we're glad to have you. So, first of all, how are addiction and nutrition linked?
I think most of the addiction centers and rehabilitation centers are doing a great job, but they're missing the link, and here's what it is. To be addicted to a substance, you know, drugs, alcohol, is all related to our opiate receptors, which are clusters of proteins that are in our brain, our spinal cord, and our gastrointestinal tract. And research shows that people that are addicted to these substances have stimulated opiate receptors. When the opiate receptors are stimulated, they release chemicals that give the body urges. If you're addicted to a substance, the urge that they give you is to have more of that substance. So I started studying that more and more, and I found that a lot of several different foods have the same effect on the opiate receptors. Sugar being a big one, gluten being another big one, certain milk byproducts, caffeine, nicotine, some dyes and preservatives. And what they do is they stimulate the opiate receptors. The opiate receptors releases the different chemicals that give the body the urges. Our body can't really distinguish what the urges are for, so it's whatever you're addicted to.
So should patients take more sugar, more nicotine, or should they stay away from those things?
They have to stay away from those things. So what the NAME program did is we developed menus for 5 meals a day, 3 meals and 2 snacks for 365 days a year, for the clinics and rehabilitation centers, because it really only works in a controlled environment, because they still need things like counseling, which is very important, what started them to want it to begin with. If you go to nameprogram.com, I have a week's worth of menus there. And if you go to dr, for Dr. KeithCantor.com, you could find lots of healthy menus, but they may not be related to what's needed for the addiction, but just regular healthy menus. If they're in a controlled environment and they're getting counseling and they're getting exercise and they're getting some relaxation and all the other parts of that the addiction centers and rehabilitations do, it gives them less urges and it increases the successful withdrawal rate from the drug. And then I allow the patients through the clinics, they have a code so they could get the menus. I allow them to give it to the patients when they leave, so those that are willing to could follow up and keep using the different menus so they don't stimulate the opiate receptors and therefore have a lower relapse rate.
That's very interesting, and it could change people's lives.
Yes, it could change their lives, and it's nothing really extra for the addiction clinics. It's just minor changes to the menus and the beverages that they drink, but it'll definitely increase the successful withdrawal rate and lower the relapse rate of the recovering alcoholics. So we're real excited about the program, and so far it looks like the clinics that are taking on the program seem very happy with it.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor, for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Susan. I really appreciate it.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Some of the top stars of R&B music, including Queen Latifah and Mary J. Blige, have signed on to star in a new production of The Wiz. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA's Shauna Renee spoke about the show and a new Miles Davis movie from Oscar nominee Don Cheadle.
We already know that Queen Latifah and Mary J. Blige have both signed on to be a part of what they are calling a live production, a live stage event that's going to air on television here in the States. Queen Latifah signed on very early on to play The Wiz, which I think is going to be very interesting.
That's an interesting choice.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, first of all, we never thought of The Wiz as being female. And Queen Latifah, as we know, is quite the presence anyway. So I am looking so forward to seeing what she does with that role. Also, Mary J. Blige is going to be playing Eveline, the Wicked Witch of the West.
Get out.
Which I think is probably, I can't imagine anyone else really playing that, because obviously this is a musical. This is based on The Wiz,
right,
which was based on The Wizard of Oz. We all know The Wizard of Oz, but it was in the context of African-American culture. And it started off as a stage play in the mid-70s, and then it became one of my favorite movies of all time in the late 70s. The stage play starring Stephanie Mills, and the movie starring Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Lena Horne. So it was a huge movie and a cultural event. So we just learned that Amber Riley, who is from Glee, she's a very popular young lady out of Glee, has been added to the cast. And what I thought was really interesting is that Uzo Aduba has been added to the cast as well. Now, many people may not know the name, but she plays Crazy Eyes on Orange is the New Black, which is a hugely successful television show. Many people know her as an actress, but do not realize that she's also played on Broadway, and she was an opera singer. She has a fabulous voice. So this will be the first time that we'll be able to see her and hear her in this form. And she'll be playing Glinda.
Wow.
The Good Witch of the
North.
North,
yeah.
Yes, of the North, yes.
Well, now, I also understand you were telling me that Don Cheadle's got a new project coming out?
Now, this is a bit different because the whole movie covers a few days in which Miles Davis disappeared into his Manhattan apartment and was reportedly haunted by his ex-wife and his glory days and images. And knowing Miles Davis, this was probably brought on by a substance or two.
A chemical or two, yeah.
But for a few days there, people were wondering where he was. What was he doing? He just went completely missing. And a Rolling Stone reporter was the one that eventually broke into the house and found him. And so Don Cheadle has been working on this project for some time. And he recently got a distribution deal with Sony. And I understand that it's going to be screened at the closing night ceremonies for the New York Film Festival, which is a huge, huge deal. And from what I understand, Don does a fabulous job portraying Miles Davis.
I definitely am looking forward to that. I'm a big fan of his. And if you're a fan of Shauna, you can send her a tweet at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. You can listen for her in the Soul Lounge. That's at our website, www.voanews.com.
Now, this sounds like a great plot for a movie, but it's actually real, and it really is exciting. You see, space scientists are holding their breath as a robot lab rides a comet towards the sun. Hi-ho, silver, I say. The lab called Philae landed on Comet 67P. You all know which one that is. It landed last November, and its mothership, Rosetta, has been orbiting nearby. Scientists hope the mission will help them discover more about the origins of the universe, and we hope they discover something after all that money, I'm sure. But anyway, Thursday, Comet 67 will make its closest approach to the sun, coming with 186 million kilometers of the blazing star. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. If you want to, we'd love for you to go to VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, stop on by our website at voanews.com. You go to the Programs tab, which is way up in the upper right-hand corner, and then you scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently announced a $65 million contribution to the UN World Food Program, or WFP. This will allow the organization to continue to provide emergency food assistance to some 4 million Syrians inside the country and approximately 1.6 million refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, and Egypt. The funds will help keep WFP programs operating through November and avert an imminent shutdown. The United States is the single largest donor of humanitarian assistance to the Syrian crisis, providing more than $4 billion to help millions of people inside Syria and beyond its borders to receive food, shelter, education, urgent medical care, and much-needed relief supplies. USAID has now given more than $1.2 billion to WFP for its Syrian operations. This includes more than $530 million for operations inside Syria and over $693 million for operations benefiting Syrian refugees. While USAID remains the World Food Program's largest donor for the Syria response, a lack of robust funding from the international community has forced WFP to reduce food voucher values by as much as half for refugees and lower the amount of food in monthly household parcels inside Syria. The United States continues to encourage other donors to alleviate these and other critical humanitarian needs. We urge all governments to fulfill unfunded pledges. The most recent contribution from USAID has helped WFP avoid having to make additional program cuts, including curtailing all emergency food assistance to Syrian refugees in Jordan who live in host communities, which would have begun August 1st. We have heard tragic stories of hungry refugees returning to war-torn Syria and taking children out of school to beg, said Dina Esposito, director of USAID's Office of Food for Peace. We hope this new funding will help mitigate such difficult choices and help Syrians as the winter months approach. Since 2013, the WFP voucher program, funded significantly by USAID, has provided critical food assistance to Syrian refugees, while also contributing about $1 billion to the economies of Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Egypt, and Iraq, all nations who have so generously opened their doors to refugees. Inside Syria, WFP's food parcel distributions have helped feed millions of conflict-affected people. The United States remains committed to working with international partners to help meet the desperate food needs of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.